Bright morning stars are rising. Bright morning stars are rising. Bright morning stars are rising.
Yes, Akimi.
Do you know what happened last night?
What happened, Akim?
Well, I saw Santa Claus, and do you know what?
What, Akimi?
He looked a lot like you. He was handsome.
I can dig it.
He was black.
Right on.
He had an afro. He was really out of sight. Now I'm going to tell everybody that I saw Santa.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Santa Claus is a black man.
Hello, and welcome to Storytime, special Christmas edition episode. Hey, Eric.
Hello, Nina.
How are you doing this 23rd of December?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Good. We just listened to a great song.
We did.
Santa Claus is...
a black man.
And we agree.
We do.
So we have two stories for you today. The first one is an original written by Eric in record time, 3 days and one Christmas break and one great original story that you will be hearing next. We will be reading it live here in studio, and it is about a little boy named Jimmy who learns the true meaning of Christmas.
Yes, well put.
After this, we will be taking a quick break, and then we will move on to Nathan Hare's Angel. That is about a boy who meets an angel, and at first you think it's just he thinks she's an angel, but then she really is an angel. So I'm excited.
Me too.
And here we go.
A heat wave hit Salinas like no other, and even the non-believers thought there might be something to global warming, or climate change, or whatever they call it. It was 80, almost 90 degrees in Salinas, in the middle of winter. The hottest winter ever recorded in that part of the country, and little Jimmy Driscoll couldn't have been happier. It's not that Jimmy didn't like the temperate weather. He thought it was okay. He thought the weather in December was a little bit like vanilla ice cream. All right. Fine, even, but it didn't have the fruity kick of strawberry or the decadent deliciousness of chocolate. It didn't even have an attractive weirdness to it, like green pistachio ice cream. The weather change for Jimmy was great news. It was as if instead of getting a scoop of vanilla ice cream, he got a banana split with all his favorite flavors, chocolate, strawberry, and pistachio. When school ended for winter break, it was 85 degrees outside, and the heat wave didn't seem like it was ever going to end. The teachers thought of renaming it Summer Break Part 2, but promptly decided that wouldn't be funny, and it was better to just stick with the traditional winter break, even if you could fry an egg on the sidewalk, as they say. Jimmy wasn't able to enjoy the first day of winter break because he had to go solstice shopping with his mother and brother. Jimmy's parents, Marianne and Joseph, weren't religious. They didn't believe in God or Santa or any cosmic being. Their faith was strictly devoted to American literature and the great John Steinbeck. In fact, they had moved to Salinas from San Francisco 5 years earlier because Joe, he didn't like being called Joseph, had gotten a job offer at the National Steinbeck Center. Joe and Marianne had good jobs in San Francisco, so they weren't sure about the move. But with a simple twist of fate, another job opened up at the Steinbeck Center, and within a week, Marianne, Joe, 5.5-year-old Jimmy, and his little brother George were the newest residents of Salinas, California. The reason the Driscolls celebrated solstice wasn't because they had pagan sympathies, but because they thought it was important that their children didn't feel completely left out of the holiday season. Marianne and Joe hated the blatant consumerism of Christmas, but something, maybe their upbringing, or maybe the pressure of pop culture and Christianity, made them buy into it in a marginal way. Instead of a Christmas tree, they would move their potted fig tree from the front porch to the living room. They'd place a brown paper crown atop the tree in place of an angel or a star. And just like that, the Driscolls' holiday decorations were complete. Even if solstice celebrations didn't necessarily entail gift-giving, Marianne and Joe still felt it nice to give presents. Educational ones, of course, to Jimmy and George. Jimmy was so happy that school was over and that his life wasn't as mundane as usual that he hardly cared that he had to go solstice shopping. When he saw Santa Claus at the shopping mall, Santa was wearing shorts and was drenched in sweat. Marianne tried to use this moment to explain that Christmas was a capitalist construct that functioned to further indoctrinate people in consumerist society by giving them an excuse to buy and give and get. She tried to use sweaty Santa as a metaphor for the pitfalls and fallacies of capitalism and Christianity, but Jimmy wasn't listening. He just thought it was really funny that this fat bearded man that other kids seemed to revere was sweating like a pig and struggling with the heat. Jimmy thought for a moment that Santa might actually come from the North Pole, because he sure didn't seem to be coping with the weather in Salinas. After passing Mr. Claus and buying a 500-piece puzzle for Jimmy and a 250-piece puzzle for George, Marianne led her children out of the mall and onto the scorching sidewalk. Secretly, Marianne enjoyed the holidays. She liked the altruism and general do-goodery of Christmas. She was enjoying Salinas' hot Christmas. Inwardly, she smiled at the symbolic mix-up of Santa wearing shorts. But after a couple blocks of sales and sellouts, she started to get sick of the Yuletide decadence and decided it might be nice to visit Joe at the Steinbeck Center in Salinas' historic downtown. As 3/4 of the Driscoll family walked through the historic center, one of the quarters started to follow behind. Little Jimmy was enchanted. As if struck by lightning, his body stopped moving. Only his head followed the movement of a curious little creature across the street. Terry Franco was walking down the sidewalk all by herself, a meek little 10-year-old with more strength and stoic poise than most adults. Jimmy looked at Terry and saw a beautiful pea-sized conundrum wearing a checkered dress and an innocence fleeting with every step. His hair was starting to mat with sweat from the never-ending sun, and his cheeks burned all around, from the outside and the inside. Jimmy couldn't take his eyes off Terry. He stared and stared until the sidewalk ended and she turned the corner and went out of sight. During the lingering moment, an overwhelming feeling started to come over Jimmy. By the time his mother called him, he was completely overcome by something strong and confusing, and a whole bunch of other things too. His entire being burned like the sun and he started to feel dizzy. He started moving his legs, one foot after another, but his head was still across the street with Terry Franco. He struggled to understand what was happening. He felt extremely happy, but the happiness was lined by a silver longing and dampened by unknowing. Nothing made sense anymore. He looked up and saw a church. He had seen the church 100 times before, but had never given it any thought. He knew God didn't exist, but now after seeing Terry, he wasn't so sure. By the time the Driscolls had all congregated at the Steinbeck Center, Jimmy was sure that this winter break would be different than the others. He wasn't going to prank Mrs. Overton or play baseball with his best friends Ethan and Trey like he usually did over the lukewarm winter breaks. This winter break, he had 2 goals. He wanted to find God, but more importantly, he wanted to find Terry. Jimmy had no idea of how to find either of them. He started his search later that night by asking his parents about God. "Who's God, and why don't we believe in him? Is he a him or a her or an it? If we don't believe in him, does that mean he doesn't exist? Or does he exist either way?" Joe and Marianne were taken aback by this sudden inquiry about God. They didn't know how to answer his questions. They had raised their children devoid of religion, and when their 10-and-a-half-year-old son started interrogating them about God, all they could say was, But Jimmy persisted. "What do you mean, You're the adults. You should know something about such a famous guy. What's he look like? Is he a person? Is he a dog? Have you noticed that God is dog spelled backwards? What does God do? Why do so many people care about God?" "Well, Jimmy, God doesn't exist. All that talk about God, well, Jimmy, it's just a bunch of stories. Stories that people, for better or worse, believe in," said Joe. "He's sort of like Santa, honey. Santa Claus for grown-ups," chimed in Marianne. "What about Santa? If he isn't real, if he doesn't live in the North Pole and give presents, why do people believe in him?" asked Jimmy, now wondering about the connection between Santa Claus and God. "People believe in him because it's nice to believe in a jolly fat man who brings presents and joy. Sometimes people just need something to believe in, and that isn't such a bad thing," answered his mother. "But the problem is," interjected Joe before Marianne finished, "the problem is that people take advantage of faith and belief. Santa Claus and Christmas are about joy and family and giving, but people make it about buying and greed, and that ruins Christmas. It's the same sort of thing with God. People believe in God because they don't know why they exist, and believing in a God can vindicate their existence. But sometimes that belief is abused, and God stops representing in beauty and love and good. That's what God should represent, Jimmy. And starts functioning as a mechanism for power and abuse. God becomes an excuse. God is a metaphor, Jimmy. A metaphor that people take literally. Do you understand?" added Joe. Jimmy didn't really understand, and instead of answering, asked his parents a final question. "If God is a metaphor, and if Santa and Christmas are about joy and family, why don't we believe in God or celebrate Christmas?" "We don't celebrate Christmas, Jimmy, because it has become more about consumerism than about family, and that means that it's become corrupt. Instead, we have our own tradition, which celebrates joy and family, sharing and giving." "Don't you like solstice, Jimmy?" said his mother. "Yeah. And the reason we don't believe in God, son, is because we don't take metaphors literally. If there is or isn't a cosmic being out there doesn't really matter, because what matters is here and now," said Joe. "Thanks," said a confused Jimmy, and he realized that maybe his parents had a couple good points, and that this God problem was maybe a bit too complicated to solve over winter break, especially because he was more interested in finding the girl in the checkered dress. His parents told each other they had done a good job answering Jimmy's questions and hoped that explaining puberty and the birds and the bees would be just as easy. They then went back to preparing dinner. Meanwhile, Jimmy was in his room planning out how to find Miss Checkers. He had no idea what he would say to her, how to approach her, but he was sure that he had to meet her. He was supposed to play baseball with his friends the following day, but knew it was more important to begin his search, so he called Trey and Ethan and told them that he couldn't play tomorrow. He then decided that he would take his bike and go to the spot where he had seen Terry. He would then cycle around the vicinity until he found her. The next morning, after having brunch with the family, Jimmy told his parents that he was going to spend the day biking around town. He told them he was going to explore Salinas with Trey and Ethan. His parents told him it was okay, of course, and he promptly ran upstairs to get ready. Joe and Marianne were happy that their son liked the outdoors and thought it of utmost importance that their children explore the world outside their home. With his parents' trust in hand, Jimmy started biking as fast as he could to the historic center. The center wasn't far, and in 15 minutes he was on Main Street. It was extra hot that day, and Jimmy was already drenched in sweat by the time he hit downtown. The color of the day was especially yellow, and after 10 more minutes of cycling, Jimmy could not believe his eyes. He slammed on his brakes and awkwardly tripped over his bicycle while trying to hide behind a tree so that he would not be seen. His luck was exceptional. After less than half an hour of searching, he had found Miss Checkers. He was flabbergasted, and the only seemingly rational thing to do was to follow her. He slowly followed her from across the street, and all the while hoping he would find some way of talking to her. Terry was on her way to the John Steinbeck Library, just as she had been the day before. She had dropped off her latest read at the library the day before, and was there to pick up a new one. Her parents could hardly read in Spanish, let alone in English, and she would always pick two books when she went to the library. One book to read to her family after dinner, and one for herself. Jimmy saw her entering the library and waited outside while he planned exactly how he would make his initial impression. He waited at the front of the library and concocted a plan. He would ask her, "What book did you get?" She would reply, "This book." And from that point on, they would be the best of friends. Of course, it didn't happen that way. When Terry left the bookstore with two books under her arm, Jimmy went to speak, but the only sound that came out of his mouth was a squeak. Terry looked at him. He coughed and tried to smile, tried to look cool and ask her what she was reading. All he could manage was a muffled hi.
Terry looked at the struggling, sweaty boy in front of her and decided to say hi back and asked him what he was going to get at the library.
Well, I don't know what I'm going to get. I was thinking of just going for a look around, you know. What books did you get? He managed to say.
Jimmy felt triumphant, as if he had just won an Olympic medal or had just made a joke funny enough that even his Aunt Theta laughed. I got The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and another book in Spanish that you probably wouldn't know. Have you read Tom Sawyer? She asked. She wasn't very impressed by the sweaty boy in front of her, but she didn't have many people to talk about books with. She hoped the sweaty boy would have something or other to say about Tom Sawyer. Jimmy had read The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. His parents had given him a copy of it for Solstice when he was 7. But, in the hopes of seeing Miss Checkers again, he chose to lie and replied,
"That's Mark Twain, right? I've never read it. Is it any good? My parents tell me he's good. Not Steinbeck, but still pretty good."
"I haven't read it yet. I just rented it," said Terry.
"Oh, yeah, right."
Jimmy said, blushing, and didn't know how to continue the conversation, even though the thing that he wanted most at that very moment was for the conversation to continue. Terry must have noticed that Jimmy wanted to keep talking to her, and with the prospects of having her first book buddy, she made him a proposition. "How about you rent the book too, and then we can talk about it. You can tell me what you think, and I'll do the same." Again, Jimmy was shocked and was barely able to blurt out a yes before running into the library. In under a minute, he was back outside in the hot winter weather with Terry.
"I got the last copy,"
he panted. "All right, can you meet me here tomorrow at 6 in the morning?"
"Sure thing."
Jimmy had no idea how he would wake up at that unholy hour and make it there, but he knew he had to. He knew his whole life depended on it. He would set 100 alarms, stay up all night. He would do whatever it took to meet Miss Checkers at the library the next day. "My name's Terry," she said.
"I'm Jimmy."
"I've got to go, Jimmy. See you tomorrow." And with a smile, Terry turned around and walked away. She had to walk for another hour before she made it home. She lived on the outskirts of town by the lettuce fields in which her parents and brothers worked. She was still too young to help them with the fields, so during her breaks from school, she would help her grandmother take care of the tiny house in which Terry, her mother, father, grandfather, two older brothers, and younger cousin lived. The prospect of having someone to talk to books about was very exciting for Terry. Her older brother Manuel had taught her how to read when she was six, and would read to the family every night after dinner. Her family loved hearing Manuel's smooth voice tell them all sorts of wonders of fiction and humbling tales of hard work. But one day, on his way to school while running across the street to make it to the class on time, Manuel was hit by a 16-wheeler and was never able to read to anyone again. The driver hadn't seen him because he had been driving for 14 hours straight and was so high on speed all he could do was to keep the pedal to the metal. By the time he noticed the Mexican teen crossing the street, he knew he couldn't stop and didn't even try to. He just kept driving. Manuel was the son of the Franco family, and his death tore a hole so big in the heart of everyone in the house that the entire home almost died of sadness. Terry was crushed, but after almost 2 months of sadness, she tried to mend the tear left in her family. She picked up Manuel's favorite book, To Kill a Mockingbird, and began to read to her family one night after dinner. Although she didn't have the same cadence as her older brother, and didn't know a fair amount of words that she was reading, her family felt the teeniest bit of happiness for the first time since Manuel's death. Ever since then, after dinner, she would read books in Spanish, many translations to her family, and after a year and a half, the grief was no longer all-consuming. After Terry left, Jimmy was overjoyed with the prospect of seeing her again. He rode his bike all around town, singing words and melodies to no song in particular. He just had to let it out, whatever it was. When he finally got home, he told his parents that he and Ethan and Trey had made the big find, and that he would have to leave home at dawn to excavate, and so on. His parents thought it was wonderful that their son was enjoying the warm weather and was back fulfilling childish pleasures instead of pondering about the existence of God. That night, both Jimmy and Terry read the first three chapters of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, and went to sleep content. They met the next day at the library at 6 a.m. and discussed all the exploits of Tom Sawyer. They did this every day for the next week, and slowly, they started to discuss other things as well. They talked about baseball, about the weather, about zebras and climbing trees. They talked and talked for what seemed, but didn't feel, like hours during the 45 minutes of childhood that Terry had each morning before she had to go back home to help her grandmother prepare breakfast. The day after solstice, the celebration at the Driscolls was traditional and as fun as every and any other year. Jimmy met Terry in front of the library at 6 a.m. The sun wasn't up yet, but the heat was still present. They only had a few chapters left and weren't sure what was going to happen after they finished the book. Jimmy decided that on this day, he would ask Terry about God. He still didn't understand the feeling that had become overwhelming in his being, and was only calm when he was around her. Terry was the smartest person he had ever met, and he thought she might be able to explain the whole concept to him. However, instead of being direct and asking about God, he asked her about Santa, and if she believed in Mr. Claus. "Santa doesn't exist," she says. "He might exist for rich kids, but he sure doesn't exist for me." After that, Jimmy was sure that the man in shorts and a beard in the mall was a con artist. How could he only give rich kids presents, but ignore the richest kid of all? He thought maybe his mom was right about Christmas being corrupt, but just to be sure, he asked Terry. "I don't know if it's corrupt or not or whatever, but my brother used to love Christmas. It was the only time of the year the entire family would be able to spend a whole day together." It was the first time she had mentioned Manuel to Jimmy. She didn't know if she should tell him about her brother or not. She wanted to, and after a few minutes of cold silence, she looked at Jimmy. She told him about her brother and her family. Jimmy didn't know what to say or do, but he felt pretty unsure about God. He didn't understand how someone with so much power could let Terry's brother die. How could he let her family live in such a small house? How could he have such an easy life while Terry had such a hard one? Terry felt somewhat relaxed after telling Jimmy about her brother. She was happy that he merely listened. She now knew for sure that she liked Jimmy. The early mornings they spent together were the happiest part of her day, and suddenly, for some reason, she wanted Jimmy to come over for Christmas dinner. She asked him if he would come by in the afternoon so they could finish the book together. He said yes. On Christmas Day, at around 1 p.m., Jimmy met Terry's grandmother and younger cousin, Eva. Her parents and older brothers had the day off, and Jimmy was also introduced to them. They spoke Spanish, and Jimmy didn't understand anything they said. But they were extremely nice to him and gave him food and love, and he liked them. Terry suggested that they walk over to the field where her parents and brothers worked to finish the adventures of Tom Sawyer. He agreed, and after saying gracias so many times that it seemed like it was the only word he knew, he followed Terry down the street and across the highway to the lettuce field where Terry's family worked. The weather was warm that day, and the sun wasn't too hot. The sky was blue with clouds here and there, and everything was tinted with an orange hue. They lay down in the field next to the green leaves of lettuce. Rows and rows of green and brown crossed the entire field around them. They slowly finished the last chapter of the book, and when they were done, they just kept on lying in the field. There was something about that moment in the lettuce field with Terry that was beyond words and hardly grasped by feelings. It could make you believe in God and in Santa, but instead it just sat there, lingering as if it would never stop.
I'll be home for Christmas, if only in my dreams. Have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree. Christmas Eve will find me where the love light gleams. I'll be home for Christmas if all
that was Red Hot Christmas, written originally by Eric Coates.
Yes. Thank you for reading that, Nina.
No, thank you for writing that. We're going to take a little Christmas break. I like how everything just becomes Christmas. It's not a break. It's a Christmas break.
Yeah.
And then we'll be back with Nathan Hare's Angel, which is an angel story. And don't worry, the music won't stop. We'll be right back with story time.
I've begun to worry right where I should be grateful, I should be satisfied. Oh, my heart, I would clap and dance in place with my friends. I have so much pleasure to embrace. But my heart is returned to Sister Winter. But my heart is as cold as ice. return to summertime. When I kissed your ankle, I kissed you through the night. All my gifts I gave, everything to you. Your strange imagination, you threw it all away. Now my heart is returned to Sister Winter. Now my heart is as cold as ice. All my friends I've returned to Sister Winter. All apologize, all my friends, I've returned to Sister Winter. All my friends, I apologize, apologize, all my friends, I've returned to Sister Winter. All my friends, I apologize, apologize.
Angel by Nathan Hare. His uncle called him a big shot. He never felt like one. He was tall for grade 10, but it wasn't the sort of height anyone noticed. He just wasn't the sort of person that made you think tall. However, his consistency was something to take pride in. He was the same thing every day, consistently average maybe, but consistent nonetheless. This changed when he saw her. His heart leapt up through his throat and bringing it back down. It was like when you think you're going to throw up, but you only end up swallowing a little bit of puke. It was a heavy weight in his chest, about as large as a boxing glove and beating as fast as a woodpecker. As she turned around and went to class, he closed his eyes and imagined what her face looked like when he couldn't see it. It was still pretty. It was a couple of weeks before he learned her name. She was arguing with a friend in the hallway. He was pretending to look for something in his locker. Angel, are you even listening? It seemed like an obvious choice. Her parents must have been smart. He found himself admiring her as a baby. And in his head, picturing her as a baby, and in his head, she had a glowing aura, the way a real angel might. The thought gave him goosebumps. He started to spend most of his time watching her. He'd notice how her hair would shift off her shoulder as she laughed, how her fingers pressed together when she was nervous, or how the wrinkles in her forehead would tighten when she was asking a question. He would watch her steps, noticing how the balls of her feet would rock. He thought she had dancer's feet. He had no idea whether she danced or not, or whether the dancer's feet even looked like. But like a pebble in his shoe, the idea remained. One night he had a dream. He was sitting in a huge auditorium and Angel was dancing on the stage. A ballet, he thought, although he had never seen one. She was wearing a tutu and pink leggings. She danced for what felt like hours, twirling and jumping in silence. Echoing booms sounded out from his feet as she landed. When she finally finished, he clapped until his fingers bled. Looking around in admiration, he realized he was the only one watching. He called out her name, but she just bowed and walked off stage. Angel was the most popular girl in school, but she had enough status to be out of his league. And he knew this. However, that didn't stop him from giving it a shot. One Wednesday, he finally worked up the nerve to talk to her. She was typing at a computer in the library. He introduced himself. She said she liked his sweater. Within a month, they were dating. He talked about Angel a lot with his friends. Man, she's so great, he would say. Okay, they would respond. I can't believe she's my girlfriend. Yep, maybe I should call her. She would come to his house on weekdays. They'd sit on the couch in his basement and stare at the wall. After bits of conversation, they'd eventually wrap their arms around each other and kiss. It was awkward, hands placed in the wrong position, and tempo misplaced. They were like employees starting out at a new job, passionate, but not knowing the little things, certain buttons on the cash register, or where the rubber bands were kept.
They were making out when he felt her back, uncovering her enormous wings. They expanded, tearing through her shirt until they almost reached the ceiling. They were cartoonish, large plum feathers draped across a V-shape. They looked like something off of a Valentine's Day card. Angel blushed.
You're actually an angel, he meant to say, but it came out sounding more like, angel?
She shrugged her shoulders as if to say, what are you gonna do? He tried to put his arm around her, but her wing kind of got in the way. He settled for a kiss on the cheek. It was a weird thing to do. A week later, they went to a Chinese restaurant to talk. They greeted each other with a hug. He felt her back to see if the wings were still there. He let out a little sigh.
I'm so glad you found out this.
I'm so glad you found out this way. They were waiting for their drinks. I was always unsure about how to bring it up.
Yeah, well, he said. I'm glad too.
Angel smiled. He watched a halo form around her head.
So, what exactly do you do?
What do you mean?
Like, as an angel.
Oh, mostly day-to-day stuff. Some miracles. Her voice became perky. Oh, check this out. A waiter and his manager were arguing outside the kitchen. With a flick of her finger, they smiled, shook hands, and parted ways.
Wow,
he said.
That was really cool.
He was playing with a piece of shrimp on his plate. Hey, did you hear about Dave and Becky?
No. Did they hook up?
Yeah, they're totally together now. A week later, they met for dinner again, this time at Angel's house. She had invited him a couple days before.
Like, at your house?
he said, picking his teeth. Yeah, my house. You've never even been over before. And my dad just finished painting my room. You have to see it.
What sort of paint did he use?
He said, ending the conversation completely. The idea of having dinner with Angel's parents made him a little seasick, but he agreed to do it anyway. He knocked on the door. He didn't hear anyone coming, so he tried to buzzer. Immediately, Angel's father was standing before him.
Eager little boy, aren't you?
For a second, he thought he had the wrong house.
Nah, I'm just messing around. Angel's inside.
He had a beer in one hand and a bag of pretzels in the other.
By the way, the name's Gary.
He shifted the bag and held out his hand. His arm stuck out the same length as his pot belly.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Gary was the exact opposite of his daughter. He wondered how something as beautiful as Angel could come from him. Things were awkward at the dinner table. Gary and his wife had gotten into some sort of argument before he arrived, so Angel's mom said nothing for the entire meal. This left room for Gary to make conversation.
So, buddy, you play any sports? No, not really, he said.
Wait, you did do that one thing, didn't you? Angel said. What's it called again, with the paddles?
Oh, badminton. Badminton, eh?
Gary said. He took a sip of his beer.
Never played it. You on the team? No.
He said.
I played once in gym class.
After an awkward supper and lots of laughter, they moved into the chit-chat in the living room. Gary was playing the hockey game, but the signal kept cutting out.
Hey, Angel, do your thing, won't you?
Sure thing, Dad. Angel got up off the couch and went outside. She then spread her wings and flew up to the roof. She fiddled with the antenna.
It's good.
Gary yelled. He leaned back on his chair. Man.
That girl, I always knew she was something special. As soon as I saw those wings. He didn't take his eyes off the screen. Yeah. Me and the old wife really lucked out.
Angel's mother said nothing. He and Angel continued to date for a month. He watched her perform miracles and fly around. Sometimes she even brought him along on her back. She wasn't allowed to bring him up to heaven, but they could float around the city, sitting on rooftops or trees. Soon the whole school knew she was an angel, and he started to gain a bit of status as her boyfriend. This didn't last very long. Angel started to spend more and more time in heaven. She said she needed to fulfill her duties, and that meant she couldn't spend that much time with him. One day, she floated down to school with another angel. Hey, I think we should talk. She broke up with him. Her new boyfriend was standing next to her.
Hey, I'm Xavier.
He held out his hand.
Hey.
Xavier grabbed Angel around the waist and flew off, and just like that, she was gone. Years later, he would talk about Angel in the office.
Man, you should have seen her, he would say. She could fly, her wings stretched out a foot wide.
The room would titter uncomfortably, unsure of whether to laugh.
Man, you think your girl's an angel? He said to John.
A newly married man whose office was next to his.
My girl Angel. That was her name. She had a glow. She was an angel.
Hey, we got a big shot over here, John said with a nudge to his shoulder.
He didn't feel like one at all.
Mary and Joseph and one holy child, giving with love in the old-fashioned style. Where is the Christ in Christmas? Let us make room in the inn. Where is the Christ in Christmas? Christmas belongs to him. Let there be Christ in Christmas. Christmas.
rest must belongs to him. My child, and peace attend thee all through the night. Guardian angels, God will lend thee all through the night. Soft the drowsy hours are creeping, hill and vale in slumber. Love alone his watch is keeping all through the night.